Okay, we're going to get going. I'm very happy to introduce our third speaker for today, Ali Gamilia Baker. Ali is a Mirning woman from the Nullarbor on the west coast of South Australia. She is a multidisciplinary artist, performer, filmmaker, and member of the performance group The Unbound Collective, who have produced such works as Bound and Unbound Sovereign Acts 1 and 2, and most recently Act 3 for Climate Century at Vital Statistics. Ali is a senior lecturer in the College of Humanities, Arts and Social Sciences at Flinders University, and has recently been appointed to the board of directors for ArtLink magazine. She holds a Bachelor of Visual Arts Honours from UniSA, as well as a Master of Arts Screen Studies and PhD in Australian Studies from Flinders University. Her research and teaching interests engage with colonial archives, cultural studies, memory, and the intergenerational transmission of knowledge. Ali's presentation today is Sovereignty, Writing and Self-Determined Spaces, and will be a discussion of voice and representation in relation to ideas of curation and writing for First Nations cultural practice. So I'm going to hand over to you now, Ali.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Hi. It's always such a pleasure to be here talking about what I love to talk about, which is art and art writing and making. And I guess I haven't always had the privilege of being able to work in to what I love. But I just want to acknowledge Kaurna Yatta, Kaurna Country, and that this institution, this university, only recently in 2016, has engaged with the process with the Kaurna community of being gifted some words, some writing, which has been embedded into the new student hub out here. And I worked closely with a lot of the art museum people at Flinders and other people who love art around. And I guess it was about a physical marker on the landscape to acknowledge the very long history of this country, of where we are. And so it is with enormous humility that I acknowledge Kaurna elders who have raised me, but also my Aboriginal family who have raised me, my Mirning mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, and all my aunties in particular, but also my uncles and my brothers and sisters. So Uncle Lewis would tell us that there is no word for horizon in Kaurna language. So it's the outer world and the sky reflecting the plains or the water, and in fact the two become one. There's a reflection, and I guess if you have a chance looking out into the concrete steps out these windows, a lot of the poetry that was gifted or the words that were gifted by the Kaurna community are actually the have seeds of Kaurna philosophy that you can drill right down into and are very deeply connected to this place. So it's really, I acknowledge my fellow speakers, and it's fantastic to be here today. I am a writer, but it's not something that I would necessarily claim first up about myself. I'm someone who's engaged in writing all my life and have just finished writing an exegesis for my PhD. And I've always felt like writing is hard for me, and it's hard, I think, to write well. But I'm also an academic, and I'm a professional teacher and talker, so I'll need to be reminded to stop. I just want to, I was going to start today by talking about the idea of the kind of social Darwinist legacy of writing in relation to Aboriginal people, and particularly the idea of terra nullius, and particularly the idea of representational justice. If we talk about climate justice, or we talk about ideas of representation and ideas of space or creating space for voice, these are very complex relationships of power. And it's only really in the last, my lifetime, in fact, that Aboriginal people have been graduating from university in this country. So engaged in the dialogue of writing of high culture, the writing of academia, the writing of the academy, the writing of philosophy and Western philosophy in particular. So Charles Perkins, 1971, Sydney University, first graduate. And here we are. So an incredible kind of identity of speaking back to institutions of power. And when I think about decolonisation and whether that's through cultural practice of making art, cultural practice of exhibiting, curating, writing about culture in its very broadest sense, I also think about what decolonisation means for me is about deinstitutionalisation, because it's the institutions that we're left with in the wake of the colonial process, and it's the institutions that remake colonial systems of power. So institutions of culture have an enormous responsibility in the ways that they choose, what that conventions they choose to uphold and what conventions they choose to discard. And I just want to look at this. So from my perspective, the way I've always looked at knowledge, and I understand my identity as an Aboriginal person is a very political thing in this country, and I've been raised by a very political family. I've been raised by an Aboriginal mother and a father who escaped from an exclusive Christian sect when he was very young and shunned, and he was also studied philosophy, so he talked to me a lot about Western philosophy. But my main biggest family is my Murning family and my Aboriginal family based in Adelaide and over on the West Coast. So we come from, my nan was born at a place called Fowler's Bay, and my great-grandmother was born at a place called Eucla. It's over the border into Western Australia. And this is an image of my nana and my great-grandmother and my whole family, and my nana's
here, my nana's brother, my great-grandmother.
So when I think about knowledge, I often think about it through the lens of my family. So how is that knowledge speaking to my family, or is it useful to us? And I think about my nana's brother was just about to go and serve in a war for a country that didn't acknowledge his being, his sovereignty, his right to be. And in fact, my grandmother was, and all of her siblings, all of her sisters, were forced into unpaid domestic labour. So the writing that I can access about their lives is related to the colonial archive, and you can go and find the enormous archive of that. And then there was a time not so long ago, so this is my nana and myself, my great-grandmother, the time before the internet, where I grew up on the outskirts of Adelaide in a little suburb called Salisbury, which is really on the periphery of this little city. And there was a time before the internet where books were really precious, and this is a stack of 8 metres of what I described as racist texts that I compiled first for Sovereign Act 1 in Fontenelle, and that was a 3-metre stack, and then the Australian Centre for Contemporary Art wanted the stack, so I said, oh, I'll reach the ceiling. So it was 8 metres, and I spent all year looking through all of the discarded texts, the texts that no one wants to have on their shelf anymore, the texts that are no longer fashionable to say that you own, the texts that, in fact, inform the canon of both. There's art writing and there's anthropological writing, and there's either a really racist description of Aboriginal people in these texts or a complete terra nulliusing of us, so a complete absencing of us from the text. So Australia, suddenly we have no Aboriginal people. So at various times and for various reasons, I jammed those texts into that pile, and they're inaccessible in a way because they're a teetering stack. They go up. And they talk about the slenderness of the narrative. And for me, when I was thinking about the relationship, the theoretical relationship I have with those texts, some of them have really informed the kind of understanding, the kind of the continuum of Aboriginal people being described as primitive, through to a kind of a dehistoricising of Aboriginal people to being completely died out or persisting with a particular kind of social Darwinist narrative around how we're going to do social policy. And then I think about it in relation to art. And when I went to art school in the 1990s in Adelaide, I had a very good art education by some really important art theorists and different people who I respected, but I was never once taught by an Aboriginal person during my visual art degree. And that spurred me on to think about coming and working within the university. So I think about those questions that remain unanswered in relation to the text, the importance of the text, the deforestation, the cutting down of incredible trees, the desire for universities to make academics write and write. So part of your justification of your existence as an academic is to write. And sometimes, and some writing that I've read has been incredibly dry and boring, and I don't want to read that. So I never wanted to read anything that I wasn't interested in. I never wanted to write about things that I didn't speak to me as a passionate person. Okay, I'm going to jump around and I'm going to come back to that. So I wanted to, this is too hard for you guys to read, so don't worry about it, but I'm going to quote Vernon Arkey. And I just, in talking about Aboriginal people and our situation and our containment within the nation state of Australia, you know, as an Aboriginal person, I make work because I really want to speak about particular sets of oppressive ideas, and that's the only reason I make work. When after I left art school, I stopped making art for quite a while until I actually thought about what it was I wanted to say. So he says, while Tall Man, so he's talking about the Palm Island riots and this incredible video footage that he compiled of various police mobile phone footage, community footage, and this incredible video installation that was at the Australian Experimental Art Foundation, AEAF, in 2010. So he talks about when we understand the circumstances. When we think about this riot that happened in Palm Island and about the lives of Aboriginal people and the way we see ourselves in times of this kind of trouble, and I'd say we are still in times of this kind of trouble. As a people, the Aborigine in Australia exists in a world where our place is always prescribed for us and we are always in jeopardy. It is a context that we are continually having to survive. In this it is a context upon which we are continually having to build and rebuild. How then do we make sense of the contradictions that present themselves in conflicts, such as this, when the conflict for a group of people has differing resonance in two communities and when only one of those communities is Aboriginal? And for me, we're never going to be popular in the sense that we're never going to be the majority of readers. But when I write and when I think about writing, I think about writing to a collective, a community of Aboriginal people who I write to and respond to. Because when I looked for writing and when I look for writing, but when I looked for writing when I was studying art, it was really hard to find. You had to go into the microfiche and you had to go into the weird little databases and you had to know what to look for. And then you might find someone who, like I remember finding James Luna and or trawling for information on Destiny Deakin, trying to find out about artists. So the archive in that sense is really, really important, but it's also about what is continually hidden in that space that becomes, I guess, what inspires you to keep going in terms of having representations of identities that are really life-saving. And in a sense, when Aboriginal people are described as innovative and valued but are continually, and now I'm reading from Vernon, are continually hampered by paternalist policies, how do we say who we are, voice our desires? We design a language and an articulation that serves us, and we ask questions that come hard to those who we are asking. We ask questions that make us difficult to dismiss. So that's what Vernon's saying, and I agree with him. I agree that it is really important that we are engaging in critical communities. As someone who lectures in the university, I know that students aren't reading a lot, but I force them to kind of read one article a week for me, and we really try and dissect where those ideas, where those writings are coming from. And I guess the idea of a critical creative collective for us was actually about thinking about ideas that bind and ideas that can set us free. So the representational power of particular sets of ideas. So if I think about what Marcia Langton has called for a critical community in relation to Aboriginal art, and I know Vernon Aki recently, well, not that recently, probably a few years ago now, in broadsheet called for Let's Be Polite About Aboriginal Art. So really those ideas around how criticism occurs and what is important about the outcomes of criticism for vulnerable communities, which I think you were talking to as well, become really crucial, and where are the platforms for those ideas to be expressed, and how do you meet multiple needs of audiences or assumed audiences. And I think for us it's about the kind of layering of those historical narratives into the present and how our family and all Indigenous peoples are represented within that. So I'm just going to refer to, I guess, the racist texts, in particular, Maria, to what you were describing in terms of the rehang of the Australian wing of the Art Gallery of South Australia. I took students into that wing every year, and it was a great way of talking about the colonial canon and the colonial narrative. And I guess there's part of me that feels very sad that I have to go looking in the second-hand shops or the library discarding sales to find the racist texts, and they've been pulled off into the special collections, and you can't actually happen upon what is our very recent history in the library in a way that you would when you wander through a library. Well, what's that book about? Oh, it's a terrible racist text. In fact, they're all being put into the special collection because we want to preserve people's sensibilities, but that is our recent history. So then how do we write about that, and how do we think about what we leave behind in relation to the colonial narrative, or what is being departed from? And bearing also in mind that there are many of our contemporaries who are still fiercely guarding the representation of the past into the future, how that narrative and how that narrative is decided upon. And also I was thinking about the guy when Brexit happened. Sorry, I'm just going to flip through my notes. Boris Johnson talking about how the British Museum has more visitors per year than Belgium. So we can leave, because people come to that museum, but people no longer read anthropological texts. So Nicholas Thomas from Cambridge is writing about how, why don't people read anthropological texts anymore? But there's still 6 million people a year are going to the British Museum to look at the conquest. So how are people interpreting what is being shown? And it, Nicholas Thomas describes Indigenous people who I've turned into curators as being a new generation of, now that the poachers have turned gatekeepers. And he was lamenting about how, you know, we should be able to happen upon things. We should be able to, like, wander through the fields like Margaret Mead and consider what is the role of... critics, including Indigenous activists, have become curators, and the newer generation of curators have been trained by critics. And so I guess I really think about this kind of conservatism in relation to the representation of history and the kind of cynicism in relation to Aboriginal people's perspectives on the museum as cultural institution, but also I guess in relation to what you were saying at the beginning, sorry, was in relation to it is the individual. So for Aboriginal people, it is an individual artist identity. So you can attack the work, but you are attacking the individual in a way, because all artists bring their own identities to that work. So in a sense, for Aboriginal people in relation to criticism, intergenerational transmission of knowledge requires that we all collectively work together for critical, creative kind of networks. And I was going to talk about that, but I will talk about it later because I've got 2 minutes. Sorry, I've rambled on, I've gone all over the place, but I hope some of that is of use in terms of kind of riffing off different ideas.